evening, folks. You are listening to Gangland Wire.
Hey, true crime fans. Have you listened to Wine and Crime yet?
We're a true crime comedy podcast hosted by three childhood friends who chug wine, chat true crime, and unleash our worst Minnesotan accents.
Each week, us gals pick a true crime topic and pair it with a delicious wine before delving into the background and psychology behind the crime.
Then we share and speculate wildly about a couple of bonkers cases related to the topic.
Past episodes include necrophilia, cults, crimes of passion, cruise ship disappearances, exorcisms gone wrong, all this over a bottle of wine, or, let's be real, three.
Listen anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Wine and Crime Pod, and check out our website and blog at wineandcrimepodcast.com.
Cheers!
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome all you wiretappers out there. It's good to be here in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown Kansas City on a hot spring day. By the time you hear this, it'll probably be a warm fall day because we're kind of booked up. We got a lot of them in the stream of podcasts coming out, and this one will go in along with we've done two prior, and this will be the third episode on Harry the Hook Alleman. I'm here with my good friend and co-host Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
You know, Harry the Hook Alleman was I guess he's deceased now, half Mexican, half Sicilian, and he was a hitman for the Chicago outfit. He was an enforcer, a street tax collector, and he was the skipper of his own home invasion crew. And we have our own resident expert on all things Chicago outfit from Chicago, Mike Burns. Say hello, Mike. How you doing?
Good. How you doing, guys?
I'm doing great. Good. So, Mike, tell us a little bit about, tell the folks, some people may not, they may come in on this one episode. Tell them a little bit about your Facebook page that you manage, and it's growing all the time. I noticed Red put up something about you're getting up around 4,000 likes, I believe.
Yep, yeah, the Facebook group's called Chicago Outfit Old and Current News Articles, and I focus on the era of, from the 1960 on up to the current day. Information on the outfit and stuff like that, so I don't really feel too much about Al Capone or that Prohibition era stuff. And we focus mainly on the Sam Giancana, Cardo years, Joey Ayupa, Jackie Cerrone, those guys. And I just basically every day I'll post articles, from various decades from the 60s up to now, anything from low level outfit members and associates to top guys. And people can discuss the articles and share stories that they know about the articles and stuff. So we're approaching almost 4,000 members now. I started the group in July of 2015.
The outfit's got enough activity going on that there's something to put up every day.
Well, unfortunately now, usually with current news, it's pretty slow around here now and stuff. So, I probably average only maybe one or two current articles a month, depending on what's going on. Right, and right now things are pretty slow right now as far as with the news and with the current outfit. But every day I post at least a minimum of three articles from the archives, basically of Chicago Tribune and a couple other papers. I'll use their archives, and I'll post anywhere from three to sometimes up to eight or nine articles a day. From various decades of older deceased outfit members, and some who are currently living or maybe retired now. But usually with the current stuff, though, I just got a busy wait. There's until the news does an article and stuff like that. And there's been a few names lately been in the press, but not much has been happening lately in the local news around here.
And you just moved personally, didn't you, to the what would have been known as what we might have called Little Italy in Kansas City? Was it to the Taylor Street?
Yeah, I live, basically to one of like the big mob neighborhoods. It still is actually a big haven for a lot of the guys who live in the area, a lot of old timers. And it's like the Grand and Ogden neighborhood where the Grand Avenue crew work out of. And so I moved about 2 or 3 weeks ago. So, yeah, I'm pretty much right in the heart of the mob area. And I've already seen one or two guys in the neighborhood and stuff like that. I spoke to one of them just in passing. He doesn't know who I am. And, I mean, I don't think he knew that I knew who he was, but I knew who he was, kind of. But it's a very Italian neighborhood, though.
You know, we'll see you sitting out on the sidewalk at a little table drinking espresso with an older gentleman wearing a $1,000 suit or $2,000 suit one of these days, won't we? Smoking cigars and drinking espresso.
Yeah, tanning myself with the little tanners.
and the feds will be down the street going, click, 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 click. Who is this dude? Who's this new guy? We got to figure out who he is. Okay, let's put a tail on him when he leaves. We got to figure out who he is. What's his deal?
Yeah, but now you can really break some news. Now you could really get some news articles. You wouldn't have to go to the Tribune. You just get them from the source.
Get them right straight from the source. I'll tell you what, Mike, that Chicago Tribune, they covered the mafia like the dew, the outfit like the dew, didn't they? God, they had so many sources of their own and wrote so many articles. I mean, God, it's unbelievable how much stuff that's in those papers.
Yeah, I mean, I get messages every now and then from people asking about, like, you know, at what point are you going to run out of information? And I tell people, like, well, there's enough articles in this archive. I could keep the group going for another 5 years.
Oh,
it's
God,
more,
yeah.
And that's not even repeating articles that I, because every now and then I'll repeat a certain article because we have a lot of new members come in. So I'll do some repeats every now and then, or if someone has a request, I'll, like, you know, dig up some articles. But I mean, there's so much untouched stuff I haven't even like begun to even look at yet and even go over. Yeah. The Tribune really covered the outfit, you know, through columnists like Mike Royko and stuff. Those guys covered the outfit a lot, and they had like 3 or 4 reporters who, you know, pretty much full-time would report on the outfit. So, there's a lot of information in there.
That Ron Koziel, he was, he covered him all over the
place. He was a really good one, too, yeah.
He's a good one to watch for. Plus, Mike, don't feel bad about reposting. I'll tell you, from a fan's viewpoint, and you can call me a fan of your Facebook site, from a fan's viewpoint, sometimes I'll see it, but I won't have time to click on it and kind of enlarge it to read it. And so I'll brush it over, and then I'll be glad when it comes back up again. Like, I tell you, for example, I commented, and I guess we're not going to find out any more information on those 4 businessmen that were killed up on the north side. And we know that was an outfit deal.
Oh, yeah, the Parker murder in 1977, yeah.
Right, and there's been several others that I clicked on because I didn't take time to do it before, and then they're gone. So, you know, when they come back up again, and if I may have time that time, so don't ever feel bad about reposting, especially your more interesting, longer articles.
I try to do. I try to, like, it's stuff that I know people will be interested in rereading, or, like, they may have missed it. Yeah, like, a lot of, like, you know, kind of key articles that I know people, a lot of people will be interested in reading. I'll make sure to repost those every few months or so, just to kind of know people really like. There's certain people, like, you know, Spilatro, Accardo, and those guys. People can't get enough of those articles. I mean, I could post 10 Spilatro articles a day.
It wouldn't be enough. Yes,
you know?
It wouldn't be
There's
enough.
There's certain guys
I know.
That people just really want articles on. So I usually will tend to, like, try to, you know, I try to mix it up as much as possible because I don't want to focus too much on one person unless I get a lot of requests. But, you know, but there are certain people that just people like reading about.
Yeah, that's probably the next multi-episode thing we ought to do is Tony Spilatro. You sent me a bunch of copies of those articles, and I've got them all in my files, and I've just never sat down and done what I did with Harry Alleman and just take several hours and go through it and make notes, and so I can make a kind of chronological sense out of it. That's the only way I can do these things is like that.
Oh, definitely.
So we'll do that. We'll do Tony Spilatro one of these days, although, you know, I guess he needs to thank Joe Pesci for being so famous. He's kind of the John Gotti of the outfit. Now that's a dubious honor at best, being the most popular, most well-known among citizens or civilians, shall we say. That's a pretty dubious honor. The real deal mob guys, they're not the ones that you know a whole lot about, like Paul Rica and the people that are really successful.
Oh, definitely.
All right, well, let's get started on Harry. I mentioned earlier that a lot of our inside information that we know about Harry Alamon came from one of his crew members from the Taylor Street crew, and his name was Lou Almedia. Lou was kind of a small-time thug, and he went to robbery for prison early on, and when he got back out, he ran into Harry Alamon, or they probably knew each other from the neighborhood. I don't know the real history of that, and Alamon gave him a $2,500 loan and to get him started back in the streets and hired him as his driver. And he said that he would claim later, after he went in the witness protection program, that he said, Harry told me, he says, just drive me and don't get lost. And that's a pretty simple request.
Yep.
I would not want to be responsible to get Harry Alamon lost, would you?
No, especially in those days you don't have the... You know, all the modern technology, GPS systems you have now where you can just type it in, which would obviously you wouldn't want to do being a criminal because the cops get a hold of your your system. They could see exactly where you were at. But, yeah, you don't want to get a guy like Harry Alamon lost.
I don't know. How well are you going to know the streets? You just got out of prison.
Well, he grew up on the streets.
Yeah,
so.
I know Louis did grow up with Harry. They were childhood friends. I know that.
Okay, I didn't realize that.
So, I mean, yeah, they did grow up. During which we'll talk about very soon, the 1977 trial, Harry Alamon's mother made a comment. It was in one of the articles that she knew Louis when she was she used to let Louis come over as a child and hang out in her home, and she would feed Louis. And she said even as a kid she thought Louis was no good, which obviously she's saying that because she was testifying against her son. But they grew up together. I don't know what age they became friends, though, but they had a long history together, Louis and Harry.
Well, here's some of the things he said about him. And the coppers that were interviewing him asking him if he thought Harry Alamon really killed as many as 20 people. And Almedia replied, I don't know. He liked to kill things. Sometimes the police, they don't know who did a hit, so I think they just put it on Harry, which was probably true. Well, they put one down in Kansas City on him.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, like guys like Splotcho and Harry, I think they were easy targets for the cops and the feds, just to kind of any unsolved murders, they could just link it to those two and something like that. And I think at later mob trials, when it came out, when like the guys like Nick Calabrese testified and during Family Secrets, and he told how like a lot of these murders, a lot of these guys, you know, a lot of these killers were not really seasoned killers. They were just put in that position to do it because they had to make their bones. And stuff like that. But a guy like Harry and Tony Spilotro, obviously that they were very good at what they did. And obviously I don't know if he killed as many as they say he killed, but he definitely had probably a good track record of murders he was involved in.
Yeah, he asked him. He said, "Well, what kind of cars did Alamon like to drive?" And he said, "Well, I don't know." He said, "You mean legit cars?" He said, "I don't know. Everybody drove stolen cars." He went on to say, you know, when he became part of Harry's crew and he would go out and do home invasions, and he said, I used to get my ammunition from Harry. He loaded his own ammunition in the garage of his house, and we had a whole kind of discussion about that, and even Frank Culotta kind of agrees that these guys in Chicago would load their own ammo with a .22 caliber for a pistol. And they would do a light load so it wouldn't make as much noise. You'd still have a silencer on it and have a lighter load so it wouldn't make as much noise. And hence that. And when you do that, that's what happened with Ken Ito, Tokyo Joe, is
yep.
the lightly loaded .22 caliber bullets didn't even penetrate his skull.
Yeah, that's what saved him, actually, was the faulty ammunition on that hit.
You're telling me maybe it's Harry Alamon's fault that all these Chicago guys want to load their own rounds?
Maybe he may have loaded them all
and
passed them around.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
He kind of got the trend started.
Yeah. What'd you say, Mike?
Yeah, I'm not sure who kind of started that trend of making their own ammunition or loading their own ammunition. Because, I mean, even back then, silencers were fairly common back then. I'm surprised silencers weren't used more often. I mean, unless they were harder to come by, maybe, for, you know, some of these guys. But you think, like, silencers would be the best way to do a hit if you're going to do it in the open, like Harry. Like, Harry was very big on wanting to do hits in the open and stuff, so you think a silencer would be the best method to go with. But apparently, I think some of these guys, maybe, I think, like, you know, like, with a loud gun going off, people might tend to, like, duck and not see the person shooting, though, too, because sometimes the loud effect of a gunshot makes witnesses will startle them. So, I mean, I guess it all depends on the view of the hitman and what he prefers, yeah, how he wants to do his hit.
I thought a lot of them used a pillow as a silencer.
Well, that's in the movies, that's for sure. Well, it's always interesting the different ways that they work. You know, Almeida, I think he's also the guy that told about, and we talked about this before, about sitting with Harry and hearing the news. I think he was sitting in the Survivors Athletic Club and talked about the news about Joey Gallo getting hit in public with, in a real flamboyant way, shooting him at his table in the restaurant. And he said, yeah, that's the way to do that. That's real gangster or something like that.
Yeah. He said Alan was really impressed with that, with the Gallo hit.
That's pretty interesting. So let's start talking about some of the crimes that we know he had something to do with. Kind of interesting. The first one we're going to talk about wasn't really Harry Alleman, but it was a couple of his crew members. And it kind of shows you how ingrained that the Chicago police, particularly this William Hanhart, which we did a show on, were with the outfit. In 1972, Almeida said that he was standing outside at Harry Alleman's house in Melrose Park talking to him, and Alleman said that he just talked on the phone with a couple of his robbery crew members and learned they had kidnapped a Hillside, Illinois policeman named Anthony Raymond. They took him to Wisconsin. They put him in the trunk of his car. After he stopped them, they got the drop on him, stuffed him in the trunk of his car, took him up to Wisconsin to a farm, and killed him. Alleman supposedly said that they tortured him to death. I don't know if they really did that, but they did kill him. And he said he told this guy that called him, is one of his robbery crew members, says, what are you telling me this for? I don't want to hear it. I don't want to be involved. That was a huge mistake. He said Harry just didn't like that. And he said the way Harry looked at him, he said, I thought he was going to have me hit for just knowing about it now, and he's the one that told me. It's crazy.
Hillside is a short west suburb of Chicago where Anthony Raymond was abducted from, and he was abducted in October of 72, and they didn't find his body until August of 73 in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. They took him, and actually they found his body in a farm with stab wounds in the back, so they believe he was probably stabbed to death.
Interesting.
And then buried up there.
And now they had robbed the Swedish Manor restaurant. I think they'd gotten a few grand out of that restaurant. That was back before credit cards were so popular, so everybody paid cash. And there was three of them. And what I find, why their connection with the Chicago PD is, the person who turned up all the clues on this was William Hanhart, who ends up running his own robbery crews, doing jewelry gigs and ended up doing time for it. But I think reading between the lines, my experience would tell me that the outfit got together and said, you know, this is way too much heat. And William Hanhart probably came to him and said, you know, this is bullshit. This were your guys. You got to help us. We got to get these guys. And so somebody gave it up to Hanhart, who was able to go out and make a case on him. Now, one of them was killed by the police in another crime. But the other two, Robert Martinez and Silas Fletcher, ended up being arrested by Hanhart and some of his squad, and they ended up being convicted for aggravated kidnapping and murder of the police officer. And I think you said that you had some information that Fletcher tried to get out on parole but was denied sometime.
He came up for parole in 95. And he was denied parole. So that's the last I could find. I'm assuming he's alive. I mean, at this point, no, I don't know. But I don't think he ever got out, and you know, a prisoner. If he still could be in prison. But yeah, I mean, like I'm actually really surprised that the outfit didn't take care of the two, just kill the people. Unless Hanhart really wanted to make it look, get headlines out of it, and bring these two guys to justice, which would also take some, because at the time, that even back in the 70s, Hanhart, a lot of people knew he was kind of sketchy in the departments and everything. So maybe Hanhart's point of view was, well, if I bring these two guys to justice, these two guys who killed the Hillside cop, you know, I don't look so much like a bad guy anymore, you know? and stuff like that. But like usually the outfit's way of dealing with stuff like this is just killing the people immediately, you know, who brought heat on them. And yeah, kidnapping and killing a police officer is not a wise thing to do, even for an outfit member or an associate to do.
Yeah, and probably Edelman would have got a piece of that robbery, more than likely. But I can.
Oh, definitely.
You have to speculate is the only thing we got right now, because Almeida didn't really go, and wasn't privy to all the details on how they made this decision. But you know, this had to go all the way up to Cardo was alive then, and Iupa was around, and you know, it had to go all the way up to the top level and say, okay, this is what happened. And now what do we do? And for some reason, you know, they said, well, here's what we'll do. We're going to let we're going to give these guys up to Hanhart and just go ahead and let the law take care of this deal. And he'll promise that he will not let this come back to us. Now, I'm surprised that they did that, because what's to keep these guys from then saying, well, we did this for Harry Edelman and his boss, and I can't even think Joe Ferriola. You know, we had to give them a piece of the action. We're part of that crew, but apparently they didn't, or if they did, they didn't. It didn't get to the feds, because the feds would have been all over that, and I didn't find out anything like that.
I don't want to get off topic real fast. I just saw this real quick. Robert Martinez, the one man you mentioned that who was involved and convicted in the kidnapping.
Yeah.
He came up for parole in 2013, and it was also denied parole for the murder of Anthony Raymond.
So it sounds like
apparently they think these guys are still alive. The Swiss Flesher and Martinez, they're both still alive and serving time, and they're still serving their sentences.
I don't know where. I wonder where. I had done a search on Fletcher in the Illinois correctional, and it came back. I didn't see his name by his first name as Silas or an S. And although when we did a search on the Federal Bureau of Prisons, it did seem to come up.
Yeah.
Silas did come up for something else that he had been paroled on, but that was back like in the 80s.
Mm, yeah, I don't know. Interesting. Well, moving right along,
If you're listening and you know anything about Silas Fletcher.
Yeah. You know, if they're in prison, maybe we could go to the prison and interview them. I just had somebody, one of our fans, got a hold of me and asked if we'd ever gone into prison to interview anybody. And I said, well, you know, matter of fact, we have.
Here's a link to the episode.
Really. It says also Martinez is up for parole this year again.
Hey.
Oh, wow.
2018.
Does it say
he'll make.
Is there a link to put money on his books?
What facility is he in?
Let's see. It says here, in this article here. All it says, the parole hearing took place in Springfield, Illinois.
Mm. Yeah, well, that would be the state capital, so.
He's got to be, I'm assuming he's probably somewhere in Illinois, maybe, probably serving out his sentence, maybe, but I don't know for sure, though. I'll look more into this.
Okay, interesting. Well, let's move along to the killing of Billy Logan, which was probably, ended up being the downfall of Harry Edelman, although it took a long time, didn't it, Mike?
Oh, no, a real long time.
Remind me, Billy Logan was a dispatcher, and he was in the Teamsters, and I believe...
He worked for a trucking company dispatcher, and he was, like a low-level Teamster guy, and he was married to a relative of Harry Edelman's at one point, and they had a bitter divorce they had at the time, and it's like that. And apparently at one point he got in a fight with they were married, but when his wife said, I'm going to tell he told his wife, he made a derogatory comment about Harry being Italian or whatever, call him a Dago or whatever. And she said, well, I'm going to tell Harry what you said. And he said, I don't give a rat's ass what you tell Harry and stuff. And apparently that's what they said may have set this whole thing off. And, I guess apparently, there's also reports that he abused his wife or ex-wife, which I don't know if that's true or not. But I think that's what set the whole thing in motion, though, with most investigators say they think that set the thing in motion. Logan's murder was over basically just personal stuff and not really a sanctioned outfit hit.
Yeah, interesting that they would do that. He almost had to get somebody's approval to do that. I had heard.
That's
read,
what I would think too. Yeah.
I read one other thing that somebody.
I
read that somebody had approached him to set up some trucks to let somebody know what was in what truck and where the trailer would be for him to hijack it, and he refused to do it. Now, I don't know. Now, that would be the kind of thing you might get the approval for. I'm kind of surprised. Harry Edelman was pretty important to the outfit, so I guess if he went to somebody and said, you know, this is important to me, they'll say, okay, you know, as long as you can get away with it.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, if I had to take an educated guess, I mean, Harry knew how things were run back then, and even if it was something that had nothing to do with the outfit, if you were a guy like Harry, you'd have to go to your boss and get permission, especially for a murder, just because his bosses they need to know if there's going to be negative impact on the outfit on this murder,
So that night he and Louis Almeida Almeida drove him over there, and he sat and waited. He knew that Billy Logan was living with his sister. I can't remember the address. Do you remember where that was, Mike?
It was on Walton Street, I think he lived on. Was it the west? It was on the far west side of Chicago, near the Oak Park border. I believe it was Walton Street.
Yeah, I didn't look that one up.
Yeah, he was murdered on.
Okay, so he had two jobs, and he was he had already worked, I think it was at a gas station maybe, and he was gone home to his sister's house and was going back out, and they knew he was going back out about 11 o'clock at night to go to his dispatcher's job for the trucking line. Either that or was vice versa, to go his gas station job. I did not make a note. I think he was going out to do his dispatching job for the truck line.
Yeah, I think he was. Yeah, he was head down. Yeah, I think it was a night job he had doing that.
So there, and he had a neighbor named Bob Lowell who was walking up the street because he wanted to sell Billy Logan a watchdog. He had some kind of dogs that he was probably home breeding dogs, and he had he knew that Logan might be in the market for a watchdog. Gee, I wonder why. I think Logan probably knew he was in trouble. And as Bob Lowell gets to the house, Billy Logan walking out just like clockwork. His neighbor knew he'd come out at that time, and Harry Edelman knew he'd come out at that time. And Edelman jumps out of his car and points a gun at him, I believe it was a shotgun, and shot him and killed him. He said he looked at the other guy, they looked at each other eye to eye and got back in the car and left. And Bob Lowell, when he got back to his house, he tells his father about it. His father says, that's a syndicate killing. You need to just shut up and get away from that deal. Do not talk to the police. He did not volunteer any information that night.
Yeah, he kept that guard dog
He kept that guard dog for himself, yes. But it always bothered him. It bothered him for quite a while. And 3 months after the murder, he went into Chicago police and picked out Harry Edelman. I think that, more I'm thinking about it, they did interview him that night, and he said he didn't.
He did. He was interviewed that night.
He was interviewed that night.
Too forthcoming. I think he kind of talked about what he saw, but his father was kind of interjecting, saying like he was telling his son to shut up and not say anything. And I think I think it was in the second interview when he came in and picked the photo out.
Yeah,
that's when he really gave more information to the cops. Then.
Yeah, that's the deal.
Isn't it kind of surprising that the Edelman and they didn't wear masks or anything?
Well, that's how bold he was, I guess.
Yeah, if you would have worn a mask, who knows how this whole thing could have gone down differently? Because it all came down to basically Bob Lowe seeing Edelman's face. Basically, he was that close to him. So if he would have worn a mask, right there the trial probably would, besides Louis' testimony, that's all they would have really had at that point.
Yeah, and here's how bad the cops were at the time. The feds know that have learned that Bob Lowe's gone in and picked out Harry Edelman out of a decent, what we call a photo spread. They get about five or six photos of guys that look similar, and he picked him out. But no case was ever brought. And then they kind of jogged the state's attorney to check on the progress of the case. And at first the cops said that Lowell was lying, and then he hadn't come into headquarters, and no one had ever showed him any photos. Then they changed their story and said that they, well, yeah, he did come in, but we lost his identification. So this case languished because of Chicago PD until 1977, which was about 5 years later, when Louis Almedia has been arrested and comes into witness protection program. And that was one of the big things that he gave up, because he was the driver of Harry Alleman the night of the hit. They go back out, they find Bobby Lowell, and he agrees to cooperate, even though he's probably already had to lay low for the last several years. But then I think he really didn't know who Alleman was. When he did, he wanted to back out, but he...
Yeah, I think one of the investigators gave him Harry's backstory, and
yeah.
I think he kind of had second thoughts, but then he still knew, he felt like he had a duty to help out and pit him behind bars. I don't think Bob Lowe was prepared for what was in front of him with
no.
the trial and everything. I don't think he knew how much, just the ramifications of what ended up happening with him and everything. It's an amazing story.
It is. And if you think about it, see, this was a state case in Cook County, and everybody knows that the outfits got Cook County and Chicago wired.
Definitely. Yeah. Even before the trial started, there was already hints of the case being fixed, even, because it was that corrupt, that the court system was so corrupt back then. The cops were so corrupt. It was back then the defendants had the choice of choosing a judge or a jury. So, right there, you give it, it was fairly, and I'm sure, and stuff we'll cover probably in the next few minutes, just shows you how obvious it was that the case was fixed from the get-go.
Oh, yeah, because you got Louis Almedia testifying that he drove him there and watched him do it. Then you got Bob Lowell. Almedia, he might be suspect because he's a convicted felon and trying to buy his way out of a bunch of other time. But Bob Lowell was John Doe citizen.
I think the only dirt they could dig up on him is he wrote a bad check once.
Yeah.
I guess on something. And that was the only dirt they could really, that Harry's lawyers could dig up on Lowe. So, he had a pretty clean history, and he was a 9-to-5 blue collar worker. So, he really had nothing to gain by testifying. He was doing this more as a good citizen.
And the outfit's not above killing a witness, and Bob Lowell.
Oh, not at all.
I read about it
at that time.
Yeah, he was. He had to leave his job. He has a job as a gas station manager. He had to leave that job, move somewhere else. His family, as it got closer to trial, was put under 24-hour-a-day guard, 7 days a week, with Cook County, and Chicago PD guys, which I don't know.
I don't know if I would trust them even back then, having the Chicago PD guard.
Oh, man.
It's like that. I know the outfit did try to reach out. They contacted Bobby Lowe's wife's sister.
Yeah.
They contacted at one point, even trying to get a location on where they were located at and everything. And they wanted photos, I think, of the family and stuff like that. But luckily the cops they got wind of that and they nipped that in the bud pretty quick. But the outfit that were making attempts to locate them. So I don't know if they were going to go as far as kill Bobby Lowe or maybe just try to offer money and say, hey, don't testify. It wasn't rare for the outfit to kill witnesses.
Well, they had an inside track to try to find out who it was in terms of William Hanhart.
Yeah, really.
Who could just go to the case file and probably look it up and tell them. And then where was that? In Gary's notes, that was I just had it here. That address where Billy Logan lived was 5916 West Walton Street.
Oh, yeah. That would have been right up the street from Billy Logan's.
Right.
That's just the far west side of Chicago. Yeah, near the Oak Park, which is weird. That area at that time, a lot of outfit guys kind of lived near that area where that hit took place, actually, too, which is kind of,
that's
a rarity
unusual.
Also
that's unusual.
Yeah, if the outfit allow a hit to be that close to, where the bosses lived.
But we're talking, this was, 5 years between when the murder happened and when Almedia comes forward in the witness protection?
When he's tried,
yeah.
And they go to trial, and as you said, Mike, in Chicago, and Tony Spilotro did the same thing, his lawyer can say, I don't really want a jury trial. I want a bench trial or a judge-only trial, and he did that. Because
exactly, and the ironic thing was, is the judge that they ended up choosing, because back then, the defendants were allowed to substitute two judges that they didn't want to be tried in front of, and one of the judges that they turned down was the judge they ended up choosing for the fix. So yeah. Right there, if that doesn't show you right there that the thing was fixed from there, but I mean, which even Robert Cooley, who was a major person to fix, that was a big issue with him, I think, too, was like, he's like, well, we can't use this judge because you already said you don't want to use the judge, you know? But that's the way these guys are, though, that, you know, they wanted to do things their way.
That's how arrogant and corrupt that whole system was, is that they turned down Frank Wilson. And then Robert Cooley, who we'll get to in a little bit, Robert Cooley is a former Chicago policeman, now turned attorney, and a corrupt attorney who had huge gambling debts at the time, and they owned him. He was a guy that could go around paying off the judges and anybody in the county, basically, but particularly in the court system, and he did a lot. And he's the one that ended up coming back around to Frank Wilson with the money. But he told them, I read the book, what's the name of that book? It's a really good one on this. I think that Ron Koziel was one of the authors. Everybody Pays. That's a really well-written book on this.
That's probably the most comprehensive book about the entire murder and trial. Yeah, it's a great book.
Yeah, and so Cooley then tells him, he said, well, you know, you can't go back and then say you want that judge. You already turned him down once, but Cooley's able to pay him off. So they just said, no, that's who we want. They go back to the system, and they control the system so bad that they get this judge who Cooley has already got an agreement with that he'll pay him off. It's amazing. And so with the end result here, folks, is you got Louis Alamedia, the driver, saying, yeah, I drove him over there. Yeah, he did it. I drove him away. You got a neighbor said, yeah, he did it. On the other hand, they've got his wife and three other friends, I think, who claim that he was a golf range. He was out driving golf balls at that time, which is at night.
Yep.
So I don't know. But, not guilty. The prosecutor had a statement that it's actually out there online. Said, this is the most evidence I've ever had in a murder trial to not get a conviction. And he just walked away from the microphone.
I remember the headlines the day after that trial. I mean, it was like every column and every reporter who was covering that story had at least saying there, this had to be a fix. The fix was in on this one because it was, I mean, two eyewitnesses. I mean, that you don't get much better than that, especially for like an outfit murder and stuff like that. So, it was, and at that time, the most of the press knew that the court system was fairly corrupt back then. So, I mean, but at that time, this is before Operation Grey Lord started. So, I mean, that the court system was just as corrupt as the Chicago police system at that time.
Yeah, they even had they had their own table, this Pat Macy and some of those mob guys who were connected to everybody in Cook County government and Chicago City government. They call that restaurant Counselor's Row, I think. And then
Counselor's Row, yep.
They had a particular table.
Counselor's Row.
That they all sat at.
The first ward table.
Yeah. That's
the first ward table. Pat Marcy. And Pat Marcy was one of the, probably the key guys in the fix, too, for that. Pat Marcy was a made outfit member who also, he was, basically the main conduct between the outfit and the city's politicians and the corrupt judges and cops at that time.
So he must have brought the judge in, and then Robert Cooley ended up paying him. It sounds to me like together.
According to Cooley, Marcy met with Cooley and asked him if he knew a judge that could handle a case. And Cooley asked him, oh, is it the Alamedia case? And Marcy says yes. And he's like, well, I have someone in mind, but I don't want to say who it is until I can get him. And then once Cooley met with Judge Wilson, he told Pat Marcy was Wilson, and Marcy got all excited saying, oh, he's perfect for this. He's great. But Marcy was, Marcy knew, I think, Wilson probably six cases in the past for Marcy, probably. And, you know, and yeah, and it was $10,000 they came to agree to pay Frank Wilson for the fix.
You know, I've written down somebody in the book, Everybody Pays, they had some exact language from Wilson when he read the verdict. And he says, he's been a judge, and I've been a judge in criminal court for over 10 years, and I've twice sentenced men to die in the electric chair, and kind of establishing that he's a law and order judge.
None of them were in the mob.
None of them were in the mob. And then he focused on the statement, the first one that Lowell gave, where he didn't identify Harry Edelman. And he said the policeman wrote them down, talking about those first statements, and then Lowe denied on the stand that he said those things because of that variance in his testimony puts it in great doubt. The first statement is inherently more trustworthy than testimony from the stand. I find that the state has fallen short of its burden proving the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And not guilty. Harry Edelman walked out. There's a little clip on Facebook of him right after walking out of the courthouse, and he is all smiles, and his family's hanging all over him. They're all smiles. they only knew what was waited.
And then I think it even came out, I mean, which we'll get to, obviously, in a few more minutes. Edelman told associates at the time also that when they would ask, like, wow, Harry, you're getting crucified in the press, and he would tell his friends, don't worry, I have it all taken care of. So, I mean, Harry was well aware. I mean, it was a well-planned fix, but not poorly executed with the amount of people that had knowledge of it. I mean, if you're going to fix a case like that, the less people know, the better it is. But you had Cooley, you had Pat Marcy, you had, you know, all of Alleman's associates and outfits who they all knew about it.
Yeah, it was really bold of them to do that. I mean, you'd think that they.
I'm surprised. I mean, I'm really surprised the outfit. I mean, the outfit stunt. I mean, for as many clever and conniving things they've gotten away with, that was pretty bold enough. Pretty risky thing to do for such a minor hit. When you come to think about it, you know, a guy like, you know, Billy Logan, he was killed for, you know, apparently, you know, him and Alleman's relative being married, not getting along very well. Usually you think you would save this fixes for something more important, like really? For like what Scalatro was charged for later and what he was, you know, with the fixes in for too. But apparently the outfit where they really wanted to protect Alleman, though, because he was that important to those guys, and he was good at what he did. So I think the outfit's thought as an investment.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, I mean, they could have even gone in there and tried to say, well, this was self-defense. He, you know, they had an argument. You know, Harry got out and he thought he saw Billy Logan reaching for a gun, so he grabbed a gun and shot him. And you know, you could have given him like 10 years and ended up getting him out about 3 years. They could have easily taken all of attention away from this with any kind of conviction. But boy, when there was absolutely no conviction and not guilty, that kept the heat on it.
Yeah, I think too with the outfit and guys like Harry, it's the ego thing of like we can get away with this. We're going to show you how bad we are. We can like Harry once said. I don't know if he may have said this to Louie. He goes, murdering people in Chicago is okay if you murder the right people. So I think that's the way these guys think. It's like they really could get away with murder because if you kill someone like Billy Logan or kill someone who wrongs them in their eyes, not doing anything wrong, you know.
Yeah, I wonder whatever happened to that Bob Lowell. Now, a little bit, I was able to learn that he was asked after the trial. He said, "Well, he said if there's a new trial, he said I'd testify again. I stood up for what I believe." But he's purportedly
after the trial. Yeah,
but he did move.
Yeah, after the trial, he kind of his life kind of fell apart after the trial, though, because he ended up they moved him to, I believe, Wisconsin. I think. Like southern Wisconsin, which really isn't that far from Chicago. Honestly, I think the first town they moved into was actually near Beloit, Wisconsin, I think. It may have been Beloit.
Yeah.
And they got him a job at a gas station, which was his old career. So it wouldn't take the outfit very long to figure out where Bobby Lowe was. But then he started heavily drinking and got into cocaine and drugs and stuff, which, I mean, obviously he was under a lot of stress and pressure. I mean, he had, I think he had 4 or 5 children they had. So, I mean, I can't imagine how tough it's got to be to testify, you know, at a major murder trial and then have to take your whole life, your family, your children, and move them to another state and stuff. And so I think he really just started, and he ended up actually stealing from his job, like the support of his drug habit. And he ended up going to prison for, I think, a couple of years, actually, in the mid-'80s, went to prison.
Well, good thing they didn't have the internet back then, because they could have found him really easy.
Yeah, real easy.
Now, you know, what's interesting to me is, so, you know, poor Billy Logan, who's murdered, just in cold blood, right? And all he is, he's like a dispatcher for a trucking company. And then, you know what? You never hear about another dispatcher for that trucking company getting murdered. I mean, I think there's a certain element where, you know, they approach Billy Logan. They're like, hey, you know, this is the freight. You got to pay it. And he wasn't willing to do that. And as a result, they killed him. There's also that element of not only do they think they can get away with it, but it sends a message.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so that the next guy who's the dispatcher probably just went ahead and gave it up.
Yeah, if that was part of the deal. I don't know if it was or not, but it probably was. That makes more sense if that was part of the deal, but not just some personal thing.
Oh, definitely.
The personal thing figured into it also. And the whole killing does not make sense, if you ask me.
No, yeah. It never seemed to add up. That's the thing. It's like, it just seemed like such a minor thing to what Al Bonomi would kill someone over for, like, you know, just a personal beef. So I always thought there'd be more to the story than just like an argument between a husband and wife.
Yeah, it seems to me like it. But anyhow, Harry Ailman, we talked about what happened to Bob Lowell and Billy Logan, of course, is dead. Harry Ailman will go on and set up home invasion robberies like he's been doing. You know, he had his own robbery crew by then. He, just like when he started, now he runs a crew, and he gives them $500 each, and they go do home invasion robberies. But he's somehow, and I didn't get the details. Do you know any more about that? He gets a conviction in either one or more of those home invasion robberies, and he goes to jail.
Yeah, what happened was the trial that he got, you know, the Billy Logan murder trial, that the not guilty verdict happened in May of 1977, and I think July, 2 months later, the feds indicted him for the his robbery crew. So basically, I think, like, according to Harry's lawyer at the time, he said the feds were just using, you know, making it a witch hunt. But obviously the feds must have had this. Obviously the feds knew enough about Harry. They had enough to indict him on the robbery crew. So, yeah, July of 77, he was indicted for, I think, 4 strong-arm robberies they did. I think that's what they got him indicted for. He ended up getting 11 years in prison for that.
So he's off the streets, comes back after that 11 yep. years. What I did find out, that he had a 30-year sentence, but did 11 years of it.
Man, if we could talk to
30 did 11, that's correct.
If we could talk to the prison guard who was watching over Harry Ailman.
Well, all they did was go paint pictures and send them out. I understand some guy, I asked a question if anybody knew where any of those Harry Ailman paintings were, and one guy said that there was a restaurant somewhere up there that had a bunch of them on the
Taylor
wall.
Yeah, Taylor Street in Chicago.
You know if those are still there, or you have any idea?
You know what? I can check. I don't live that far from there.
Okay,
I
thought
about going over there.
Hey, if you do, take some.
Still there.
If you do, take some pictures of them and post them.
Right.
Send them to me. I'll post them.
Yeah, get that address.
Yeah, that would be interesting. He's painting pictures, and he comes back out. And here's something that Joe Ferriola was his uncle. Remember, it was his mother's, who was Italian, his mother's brother. His first boss, and he had died in the meantime, and you think of these guys, they only leave, like, you know, cash money to different people, and he left $100,000 in his will, which means that it had to be in a bank somewhere, or you wouldn't have worried about the will, and so he comes back out, and he's got $100,000 to start back up business with, moves in with his family, and back with his family in Oak Brook. He is always a family guy. His son-in-law runs a concrete cutting business, Accurate Coring Company, at 825 Seegers Road, Des Plaines. I don't know if that's probably not, doesn't still own that company.
It's right next to O'Hare Airport, like in that area.
Okay. Des Plaines is not that far north, then, is it?
No, not at all. It's probably maybe 20 minutes north of Oak Brook.
Well, when he first gets out, he's like, and I've seen this, these guys, when they first get out on parole, they mind all their P's and Q's. Whether you're a two-bit drug dealer or you're a guy like Harry Edelman, they always mind their P's and Q's. And what I was able to learn is he went to work every day. He was the office manager. And his wife would say that during that time it was the best time of their lives. She said they cooked together, they shared meals. He was there with the family. He was always there with the family a lot, but that was some of the best times
One of his grandkids was sick and had to have surgery, and I guess here he stayed by his bed in the hospital the entire time the child was in the hospital recovering from surgery, and Harry never left the hospital at all the whole time and stuff. And yeah, they said like his stepdaughter and stepson all said Harry, you know, he would pick him up from school every day and take him to school in the morning. And Harry, he got out April of 89 is when he got out for the robbery charge, the sentence, and he was reindicted then that February of 1990 Bakia police, in that whole Operation Good Ship Lollipop.
And what was that about? What was that about? I see I've got some notes that here was, about bribery and beatings and murders and the gambling.
That one covered gambling, murder, extortion, loan shark. I mean, it was 20 people were indicted. Rocky and Felice was the main guy, Sal De Laurentiis, Luis Marino, Robert Bellavia, and like all the Cicero guys were all indicted, and Harry was indicted. Harry's part of the indictment was for the Anthony Rettinger murder, the 1975 Halloween murder.
Oh yeah,
and
we talked about that.
They mentioned the Logan murder, but he wasn't charged with it because technically it was double jeopardy. But in the indictment, it was brought up that he was a top suspect still in the Billy Logan murder and stuff, and also and he was also indicted for extorting bookmakers. They got him on for that one, and so that was in February of 1990, and I think it was the day before the trial was to begin, Harry pled guilty to extorting, not to the murder of Rettinger, but extorting the bookmakers and stuff. And he ended up getting sentenced, I believe. That one was 10 years, I think. He took a 10 to 12 year sentence on that one.
They probably didn't.
He was looking at, though, if he was looking at a longer, if he would have gone to trial, he was looking at a lot longer. And I think his lawyer advised him just, you know what, just plead out and you'll be back out in the streets and, you know, in 10 years, at a minimum of 10 years.
Yeah, they must not have thought they could make him on that, get him convicted of that Rettinger murder. They must not, must have been
I think Harry knew it, but I think the thing that he was nervous about was they had so much, because the main witness was William Jehoda, who was the top bookmaker for the Infelice Cicero crew.
Yeah.
And he wore a wire on all those guys. Not Harry, though. He never got Harry on tape. But he wore a wire on all those guys, and there was so much damning evidence on those wires that just with Harry's name being lumped into that trial, Harry knew he was going to go down with everybody.
Yeah.
So I think he pled out before, which was probably a good thing because all those guys got convicted, and some of them got convicted for murdering Hal Smith, who was an independent bookmaker in 1985. And I think Harry wanted to separate himself as much as possible from any murders in that indictment.
Now, here's kind of an interesting little tidbit I picked up. He asked, this was in federal court. This was federal extortion, probably part of a RICO case maybe. And he asked the judge if he could be sent to a prison at Oxford, Wisconsin, because they had a really good painting program and he wanted to pursue his painting hobby. Said he'd been there before,
that's right, yeah.
And he enjoyed the artwork there and the painting programs. And plus, Oxford was the best for landscape and still life. So,
looking out the prison windows, painting some landscape. Now, is it?
It seems like it's kind of pushing it. It's bad enough that you're pleading guilty to all these crimes, and then you're asking the judge for a favor. Then, this very nice prison because it's got a great art, a great art class, and also it's got great scenery outside the prison. Oh. And I've driven by that. I used to have relatives in Wisconsin. I used to drive by that prison all the time. And if they think that's beautiful scenery, then I don't know what they consider beautiful scenery, but it's very depressing scenery if you ask me.
Sounds like another address for the.
I guess if you're locked up in prison, anything looks good.
Yeah, really.
At that point.
We need to do a 1970s mob crime tour of Chicago. I think that thing would be immensely popular. I really do.
Oh yeah, in the 1970s there were so many. I mean, that was probably the height of the killing, at least in the modern day outfit.
Yeah.
The 70s was probably the most violent decade of murder. I mean, that's one thing I learned going through these archives. And you just type in a couple keywords like mob murder and type in like 1970s. I mean, hundreds of articles will pop up.
Now,
amazing amount of articles that pop up just covering, you know, murders that took place in the 70s. It's like, I mean, because you had Joey Iupa, who was the boss, and he was known for, you know, pretty much, you know, issuing executions at the drop of a hat. You know, he definitely was, you know, like sending a message out instead of like, you know, some of the later bosses would rather like kind of do a low key thing, but like Iupa liked to send a message.
Was that so? When you do a Google search of the Good Ship Lollipop, which was the name of that investigation, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't tell you that that investigation was run by Shirley Temple.
Shirley Temple.
Why do they have to call it the Good Ship Lollipop? We're the outfit in Chicago. We're the baddest men in the mob, and they're calling this investigation the Good Ship Lollipop.
I know, if I remember correctly, I don't know if it's the, I don't know if that's what the mob guys nicknamed their opera. I think Infelizno's guys nicknamed their operation that as a joke, kind of like their code word for it, because they had a floating casino. They had a house in northern Illinois that they opened a casino in, and the house they opened a casino in, a family, a husband and wife was murdered in the house, but not by the mob. One of the children murdered the family.
Yeah.
And the house sat there vacant for years, so the mob ended up buying the house or renting it and using it as a casino, and they ended up killing, I think they killed one bookmaker in the casino, and that was one of the murders that was covered in the trial. But if I remember correctly, I think on one of the wiretaps that William Jehoda got of Infelice, that was a code name. Like the Good Ship Lollipop was the name of the casino. That was like a nickname for it they had.
Yeah.
And I think that's why the feds may have called it that or something like that.
Yeah, probably.
You know, that's why I'll have to do more research, but I believe that's why they nicknamed it that.
Well, that'd be another interesting address on that 70s Chicago outfit tour is, where is that house up in Wisconsin that they did the gambling in?
Oh, yeah. It was called, nicknamed the Rouse House, R-O-U-S-E, because that was the last name of the family that was murdered in it. And it was in, I believe, what town was that in? It was a northern suburb of near Gurnee, where like Great America is. That it's like, it was like up there, and like near Waukegan, I believe. I know it wasn't Waukegan though, but that's where the house was located. And the reason why it was a good location was it was a mansion located on property of like, I don't know how many acres, but it was basically hidden away. And the outfit paid off the local cops to keep the legit police away from it. So like, cause the cops were in on it and stuff. And the casino only ran for about a month. And during the trial, I think Jehoda testified that they pulled in like something like $3 million profit in just 1 month in the casino.
Wow, that's amazing.
But Ailman couldn't buy off that judge, so he had to ask him for a better venue to sit at and paint pictures.
This was a federal judge.
Oh, wow.
That's why the other one was a Cook County judge.
And at the time this trial started, right when this trial started is when Robert Cooley was exposed as FBI informant working with the feds, and so that's when everyone knew. I think guys like Ailman knew that more indictments were going to be in the future that since Cooley flipped. So I think a lot of these guys were like trying to plead out and hopefully that they couldn't be retried for these murders or other crimes once Cooley flipped and which obviously ended up happening to Ailman in the end. But the 90s were definitely a big downfall for these guys. Once Operation Gambit and Greylord took place in the 90s, or the 80s and early 90s, the outfit lost control of fixing cases, and a lot of these guys were, you know, they knew they were pretty much headed to prison for a good portion of their life.
Yeah, that Operation Gambit and Greylord, they really took a lot. They took down their influence out of the court system, and boy, when they lost that, they lost everything, really.
Oh, everything, definitely. Yeah, the first ward, yeah. And I think they even caught Accardo on a wiretap even saying that. He goes, like, Accardo was caught saying, they, you know, they destroyed us. You know, we're ruined now. Because, I mean, that was their, that was a key to the outfit. I mean, having the first ward was like, you know, having the key to the city, basically.
Yeah,
I mean, they
really
controlled, the first ward controlled everything at the time. So by losing that, I mean, all those decades and decades of payoffs and everything of, like, pitting your own people in power all went down the drain.
So here we are at the kind of the three quarters of the way, shall we say, through the career of Harry the Hook Alleman, feared outfit enforcer and hitman. He survived a murder trial, got him a not guilty. He's robbed a lot, done a lot of home invasion robberies. He is the most feared enforcer, if you will, in Chicago for the Chicago outfit. I don't know if there's anybody more feared, anybody's name that's more feared than Harry Alleman about this point in time. What do you think, Mike?
Oh, probably not. Yeah, I mean, just that, like, I mean, there was guys who would use his name to collect debts, and people would pay up just hearing his name. So yeah, he was probably one of the most feared guys.
So he's in. He cops his plea on this extortion of some bookmakers. Probably all he got to do is say, "I'm Harry Alleman. I'm here to collect," and they start handing him money.
Oh, exactly. That's exactly what they did. Yep.
And this is late 80s, early 1990. It looks like he's getting ready to get out of the penitentiary from that when he gets some really bad news. And that comes out of that Operation Gambit. And our friend Robert Cooley, former Chicago police officer, lawyer, and all-around fixer for the outfit. So he's been working undercover for the feds. He actually, I don't know if they had a case on him, or he just got felt guilty and came in. Do you remember?
When he came in 1986. He went to the Strike Force office, and the first thing he demanded before he gave him anything was he wanted to know if they were working on any cases against him. And the feds said no, they weren't working on anything on him. And so that's when he agreed to wear a wire and stuff. So yeah, Cooley to this day claims he did it all out of conscience. But there are people who said that he did it out of fear, that because he did have outstanding gambling debts to the outfit that ranged into hundreds of thousands of dollars. But, I mean, a guy like Cooley was pretty well protected, though. They wouldn't harm Cooley, probably, just from all the favors he's done for them. But some people believe that that's what his motivation was. But Cooley does claim that he did it more because his father was an honest cop at a time when honest cops really got a bad rap. So I think Cooley claims that he did it for his father, basically, because he felt bad that his father was such a good guy his whole life. And here Cooley was, made a career, a mockery of, like, the criminal justice system. And Cooley at one time was a Chicago cop, too, and he took bribes. So Cooley basically was the opposite of his father, basically. You know, his father was this honest cop at a time in Chicago when things weren't so honest. And then here comes, you know, then his son is probably one of the most corruptible lawyers and at the time and stuff. So I think, you know, I mean, I'm sure it's probably a little from column A and a little from column B. I'm sure Cooley had probably a little conscience, and at the same time probably figured, hey, it might not be too bad to get these outfit bookmakers and enforcers off my back trying to collect a couple hundred grand from me.
Yeah, really. That's kind of the government. Government will give you some money and create a new identity and a new life for you, and you can dump off several hundred thousand dollars in gambling debts is probably not a bad deal.
And that's what they ended up doing. They ended up giving Cooley money to pay off the bookmakers because they wanted to make cases against the bookmakers.
Wow.
So they ended up giving Cooley, they didn't give him all the money, but they gave him, like, because I guess each payment would be one count of the indictment. So they wanted Cooley to make small payments so they could get as many indictments as possible against these bookmakers.
Interesting.
So, I mean, the feds really, they really did work the case really well. I mean, because they got from the low-level bookmakers all the way up to, like, top, the high reaches of the outfit with guys like Pat Marcy, who, I mean, next to Cardo and probably the outfit boss, is Pat Marcy's probably one of the top guys up there, too.
He certainly had the power because he had the connection to the politicians and the judges and the prosecutors. So let's...
I wonder if he used that money to place a few more bets and not just pay off a debt because he has a gambling problem.
Well, maybe he went into Gamblers Anonymous. We can only hope.
Does the feds have a witness protection program for that? Because he'd probably be easy to find if he went into witness protection and he was still the gambling problem.
You know, he was in, but I think he's a lot of them that came back out again and was using his own name. There's a video of him being interviewed in later life online. I kind of tried to reach out to see if I could get a response from him, but I couldn't seem to get one.
Yeah, he goes under his real name again, and at one point, at least on his Wikipedia page, it gave his exact location of where he was living currently. But then when I went back to see it again, it was taken off immediately.
Huh. Interesting.
And if I remember correctly, it was somewhere like Spokane, Washington, it said he was living. I mean, I don't know, it's Wikipedia, so who knows how true it is. But he has given many interviews. Even the last couple of years, when his book came out in 2001 or 2002, he actually came back to Chicago and did some autograph signings at local bookstores. But there was a big police presence, obviously, you know, when he did it. But in one interview, he claimed that he planned on moving back to Chicago. But I mean, this was years ago. I don't know if he ever did. I mean, honestly, if he did. Everyone he put in prison is dead, besides like guys like Marco D'Amico and his crew. Those guys are still active, so I don't know how dangerous that would be for him. But, I mean, if he knows what neighborhoods to stay out of, things like that, he's probably not. Like, a guy like Frank Calabrese Jr., I mean, he's back in Chicago, and he's not too hard to find. So, I mean, I think these days, the outfit, this kind of stuff, I mean, I think they kind of left. It's definitely not the same outfit as it was back then. I mean, a guy like Frank Calabrese Jr. or Robert Cooley gets hit, the feds are going to be all over those guys.
That's true.
So I think those guys know it's like, well, you know, they can't really, I mean, they're kind of untouchable in a way. I mean, I guess depending on what they want to do to them, but I mean, there's a certain kind of like stigma, like, well, you know, is it worth killing a guy like Robert Cooley to have the feds come down that hard on you? You know, is it really worth it to them?
Yeah, probably not. And, you know, Calabrese Jr. and Frank Culotta, both, all you'd have to do is book their tours, either in Las Vegas or Chicago, book their tours,
yeah.
And you know exactly where they are.
Calabrese Jr. is actually, him and I speak on a regular basis, and him and I actually worked together at his former pizza place that he was part owner of. He actually got me a job there.
Oh, really?
And so I worked with him and something like that. So we would talk, you know, just talk about some outfit stuff. And he shared some recent stories just about stuff like people he's run into in Chicago. And he's run into some outfit guys, and he's never had any major problems. But he said there's been a few kind of like, a couple of tense situations where like, it was, you know, it never got to a fight, but it was kind of like they were unhappy he was, and he was unhappy that he was there, basically.
Yeah.
But like, I mean, but also Calabrese Jr., though, the only person he really testified against was his father. I mean, it's Nick Calabrese is the one I think they would rather look to get their hands on, because Nick really testified to pick guys like Lombardo and Marcello away. But Frank, you know, I think a lot of people understood the position Frank Jr. was in, though. His father was a monster of a man, you know.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of outfit guys kind of felt bad for Frank Jr. in a way, too. You know, I mean, he grew up in a very rough household.
Yeah, it was like his father put him in a position where it wasn't any choice. But his uncle, Nick, he's the one that brought everybody down in that family secrets trial.
Exactly. And
Frank
didn't
know
enough. I think that the outfit would really like to see. Exactly. Yeah. Frank knew enough to put his father away, but everything else he kind of knew was all maybe hearsay or stuff he captured on tape with his father. But Nick, corroborated everything with it. So I mean, but still, yeah. Frank told the feds that even that his main focus was his father all along. He wasn't looking to put anyone else in prison but his father.
And he was so young at the time. I mean, really, he hadn't had a chance. He'd just done stuff for his father. He had not branched out and done a lot of things for other people or with other people. He wasn't,
Yeah, it was Uncle Nick actually who saved him in the end, because Frank Jr. was supposed to be the trigger man and John Fekirota hit.
Yeah.
And it was Nick who ended up doing the hit for him. So, I mean, so Nick actually saved Frank Jr. from basically a future of being an outfit member and probably either wind up in prison or be dead by now, you know?
Yeah, interesting. Well, I think I may have said this earlier, and maybe in the Facebook thing, I messaged him. I'm trying to get him to come out to Las Vegas to our Mob World Summit. That would be fun to get him to come out.
Yeah, I'll give him a call.
Yeah, if you're talking to him, just mention it to him.
I see him pretty regularly.
He wants to know how many people
are. He'd be definitely interested in doing.
Yeah, he is interested. I understand he needs to make money, and he wants to know about how many people are going to come. And I'm not sure yet. I'm going to get hold of the guy that's been managing the Eventbrite site and see how much interest there is so far. You can never tell about those deals until the last minute. I know the last one we did, Frank, is 2013. There was probably 125 to 150 people there. He sold some books, and he really puts on a good show.
Yeah.
As far as telling stories, he's great.
Frank and I did a small event at the pizza place that he used to own back in, like, August. And, you know, it was a local thing, and we got maybe, like, 30, 40 people out. But, like, yeah, it's so hard to gauge and what those events will bring in, and how much time you need to plan and promote and everything. So, it's tough to do.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll talk about doing something all together up there in Chicago. We'll that might be something
we would investigate
and kind of combine audiences and
do a mob summit up in Chicago.
If we could just get the press to say something about it. We need to get more than hardcore mob fans to ever think about making any money. But it's a possibility. Let's keep that in your mind, and we may do that. In the meantime, Mike, you can come back and do one more episode, and we'll finish up our good friend Harry the Hook Aleman, can't you?
No, sure, yeah.
All right, great. I'm going to do a public service announcement now, and we will get on out of here. If you have a friend or relative that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for purchase on Amazon for only like $7. You're going to want to watch that over and over again, because there's some great audio clips and interviews with the folks that brought the mob down in Kansas City. For Skimming in Vegas, a documentary by Gary Jenkins that inspired him to create an app called the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For like $1.99, you could take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And then if that's not enough, Gary's got a new book, Leaving Vegas:
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
It's a great read, but it's an even better Kindle because there's hyperlinks to the actual audio from the wiretaps distilled down with transcriptions so that you can understand what these guys are saying, because they're talking in code, they're talking in Sicilian, and they're the actual men. From the mouth of the men that did it, it's Leaving Vegas: How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination in Las Vegas. And then if that's not enough, you need to subscribe, share, and support Gangland Wire.
Yeah, do that.
We can't really talk about the Mob Summit. You're going to hear this. We'll already have done the Mob Summit.
It's going to be after the Mob Summit. Yeah, we talked a little bit, but it's more personal on talking to Mike and planning on stuff for the future. So, Mike, it's been good talking to you, and we will talk to you in the next fourth and final episode about Harry the Hook Aleman. Good night, Mike.
I'm good.
Say good night, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Automatic. Follow them on Twitter at Automatic Music. You know, I was going to say, and maybe it's better in the kind of the break segment here if you don't put this in. Mike, if you go back to Wikipedia, usually if there's been a page established that somebody has written something on, you can, if you're logged in or not, but you can go back to previous versions of that page and it will show you how it appeared.
Oh, really?
Yeah. This guy.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, go do that, and you can go back and kind of look at the history of the page as people add to it, and you can see older versions of whatever that page was. So, I was gonna say that in the episode, but apparently the secret word for this episode is coolie. See if Gary leaves that in. Hold on, let me bring Gary up.
be something we could put in at the end of the episode here.
If you really want to know where Cooley lives, you're going to have to listen to us talk about how I tell people that they could actually find it by...
You know. Now, how do you do that, Aaron? Say that
if you
again.
Go to Wikipedia.
And what?
And there's
what?
Like a page history. When someone creates a page and then they edit the page,
there's
a history there, and you can go and look at various... revisions of
the
Wikipedia page.
I never noticed
that. I imagine that if there was an address or other information that somebody maybe took out, that if you looked at one of the older versions of the page, it would still be there.
Interesting. All right, let's
check that out.
Yeah.
Well, I'm hoping I'm right. I mean, I've done this before on Wikipedia where I've gone and looked at the history of a page revision and found different information. Maybe we get Cooley to come out.
Yeah, really. Maybe if we could find Cooley. I did try to
I'm going to run to the restroom real quick.
Okay, he's going to run the bathroom. I did try to find the FBI agent that brought him in, a guy named Terrence Hake. I had a connection with an FBI agent that knew him or knew somebody that knew him or something, and they were going to send him the message and see if I couldn't get him to do a call-in show about Cooley. That would be good, but I've never heard from him. I'd forgotten I'd even did that until I'm looking back at my notes. I was going to say that in the but now I realize that guy's never gotten a hold of me. So you never know about these deals. I'll go back to my connection and see where we're at on that, if she had ever done it or what the deal was. All these FBI agents have their phone numbers and contact information in the retired agents directory. And Bill Owsley, our oftentimes contributor here that comes in, he'll help me find FBI agents to see if I can get them to come on my podcast. Most of them got some kind of a book to sell, so they're happy to come out and do stuff like this.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm thinking about that. Aaron was on me one other time to try to go up and do some kind of a meetup in Chicago, and I kind of, I don't know, I wasn't in the mood at the time. But I'm doing less other work and not so busy now, so I may think about putting something like that together.
It's a hard thing to do because it's like when you try to do those things, you get people saying, I wish you did it this day. I can't make this day.
Yeah,
and sometimes I know. It's hard. It's almost like a full time job to be able to
do it. It is. To do an event. Yeah.
You got to find a location, and then you got to promote it, and then people, are bitching because it's too far, or why can't you do it this day? It's almost to the point where it's like, is it really worth it? It is worth it in the end, but yeah, it is a lot of work though.
Yeah. I don't think we've
but it's
done.
It's a good idea, though. I mean, it'd be fun. I mean, I'd be willing to help out and do it. I think it could be a really fun thing to do. But I mean, something like that. I mean, it definitely takes some planning. That's for sure.
It would, and it would take some outlay of cash. I think I would definitely want to charge something for it. I believe that people value things more if they have to pay something anyhow, as opposed to if it's just free.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
So I don't know. We'll talk about that over the next few months. I don't foresee anything this summer, next winter or next late fall. Maybe it'd be the earliest I'd want to do something. I'm kind of going to dug off this summer a little bit and take some time away. I've got a bunch of podcasts in the can, and sometimes you just need a break.
Going to get some more in Vegas.
Yeah,
we'll get some more in Vegas. We got a guy, this Robert Andretti, I can't pronounce Andracci or something. He's a former Illinois state investigator that did a mob thing, investigation and gambling in a suburban Chicago area. He's got a pretty good story to tell. I'd like to get that gal, that Lefty Rosenthal's gal, to sit down and do a podcast for sure. And I'm trying to think. Seemed like there was somebody else that was going to be
Finno?
Out there. Oh, Ronald Finno. I'll do one with him out there. He's a really, you don't know him. He's a really interesting, great storyteller. He's got a book called The Triangle Exit. He was, his dad was a Buffalo, New York mob guy, and he was in a labor union as a job as a younger man. And of course, he was loosely connected because of his father, and he ended up, I don't remember the exact detail, but he ended up actually working for the FBI and then maybe the CIA after that for years. as a like a contract agent and going in and doing things. And this guy, he is a dynamic dude, and I could see where he could do it. I did a program with him before. Out there at the Mob Summit, and he really totally overshadowed me because he had such great stories. And I mean, he's all the way up to talking about selling guns to Al Qaeda and later in his career. So he's a good dude, and we want to get him talking about his career. I just have never done it. Now that he's going to be out there, we'll get him. So anyhow, let's go ahead and start this. Do you want to start it? Do you want to just go from dead stop here?
I got it queued here.
Right? Okay, he's going to bring down the mics and cue back up the music and go back in. Mike.